From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John McPhee's essays combine the precision of good reporting with the narrative grace of good literature. His books have explained the forces of geology, the intricacies of tennis and basketball, the secrets of canoe making, and man's attempts to gain control of nature. On today's Fresh Air, McPhee discusses the control of language. Also today, screenwriter and father Lowell Ganz discusses his new comedy, Parenthood. Eileen Segalov takes us to the unusual exhibitions in the Museum of Jurassic Technology, and Mark Halliday reads a new poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. There have been two more incidents involving domestic passenger jets. A Braniff Airways 727 on a flight from New York to Florida made an emergency landing at Newark International Airport today after a faulty warning light indicated a problem with the plane's hydraulic system. The plane, carrying 106 people, landed safely. It was a safe touchdown, too, for an American Airlines DC-10 loaded with 189 people. The plane returned to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport after a vibration developed in the nose gear. The jet later was allowed to take off for New York for repairs. Meanwhile, in Denver, a Northwest Airlines DC-10, whose number 2 engine broke apart in flight earlier this week, took off today for Minneapolis, where repairs will be made. The federal government gave special permission for the flight as investigators try to figure out the reason for the shrapnel-like hole still in the engine's casing. Lance Ross reports.
The Federal Aviation Administration deemed the plane airworthy for today's 2-hour flight to Northwest's Minneapolis maintenance base. The number 2 engine was shut down for both takeoff and the entire flight. The Northwest DC-10 left Denver's Stapleton Airport operating on only 2 of its 3 engines. The plane made an emergency landing in Denver when the tail-mounted engine started to break apart Wednesday night while the jumbo jet was at 38,000 feet. Last month's United Airlines DC-10 accident in Iowa was caused when the tail engine exploded, cutting control lines, but federal investigators stressed the differences more than the similarities, especially the differences in engine manufacturers and design. For National Public Radio, this is Lance Ross in Denver.
The White House says patience is the chief virtue in handling the hostage crisis. The statement comes in response to the latest conditional offer of help from Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, spiritual leader in Lebanon of the pro-Iranian Hezbollah movement. Michael Richards has more.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today said that now is the time to lower our voices a little and see how the stepped-up effort to free the hostages plays itself out. Fitzwater said there have been no direct contacts with Hezbollah, although the United States is willing to talk to anyone who can wield some influence. The Hezbollah leader, Sheikh Fadlallah, speaking at a Friday prayer service in Lebanon, said that everyone should, quote, seek together, each by his own means and influence, to end the crisis of hostages. All hostages. That includes Arab prisoners held by Israel. Fadlallah's remarks follow a series of reports from Tehran that indicate Iranian willingness to work for a solution, including indications today that the new Iranian president, Ali Akhbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, is attempting to keep hardliners out of the cabinet. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
Darkness has halted for today the air search in Ethiopia for the missing plane of U.S. Congressman Mickey Leland and 15 others. On Wall Street near the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 29 points at 2682.66 in heavy trading of 195 million shares. This is NPR News. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission plans to fine Philadelphia Electric Company $75,000 for lack of preparedness in the event of an emergency at its Limerick nuclear plant. Beatrice Black of member station WHYY has more.
NRC inspectors observing mock emergency drills conducted in May found that 4 of the 5 shift supervisors at the Limerick plant near Pottstown, Pennsylvania, were unable to quickly classify the severity of an emergency. NRC spokesperson Carl Abraham says in a real emergency, that could spell costly delays in getting information to local and state authorities responsible for public safety.
They need to have rapid and accurate information from the control room of the nuclear power plant when something has gone wrong.
A Philadelphia Electric spokesperson says the company concurs with the severity of the violations and has agreed to pay the $75,000 fine. According to the utility, the shift supervisors who failed their test in May were redrilled last month to the NRC's satisfaction. For National Public Radio, I'm Beatrice Black in Philadelphia.
The United States today condemned what it termed a slaughter of innocent people in escalating fighting in Lebanon. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler urged Syrian Christian forces and various other factions to stop the shelling, which in the past 36 hours has reportedly killed 40 people and injured more than 150 others. Battles flared 5 months ago when Lebanese Christian Army Chief Michel Aoun declared a war of liberation against Syria's estimated 40,000 troops deployed in Lebanon. Israel's army today doubled to 1 year, the period that Palestinians can be jailed without charge or trial. A military statement says the action was taken for security reasons in light of the continuing rebellion against Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel has defended detention without trial as an effective means of arresting violent leaders of the uprising while protecting informants. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. John McPhee is one of America's most respected and envied writers, respected for stretching the artistic dimensions of reporting, as William Howarth once put it, envied because his status as a New Yorker staff writer has allowed him to spend months or years on a story and to take as many pages as he needs to tell it. As for subject, McPhee writes about people, places, occupations, and phenomena that interest him. He's written profiles of tennis star Arthur Ashe, basketball player and senator Bill Bradley, curator Tom Hoving, and physicist Theodore Taylor. His interest in geology and the outdoors have led him to pieces on Alaska and the Pine Barrens. Oranges told the botanical, processing, and marketing history of the ever-popular citrus fruit. McPhee lives in Princeton, where he grew up. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1965. Most of his New Yorker pieces are later published in book form. His new book, The Control of Nature, features three reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides. I asked what led him to the subject.
I have a daughter named Sarah, who was in college in the 6 or 7 years ago, and was taking a course from Robert Coles on the work of Walker Percy. And she was totally swept away by Walker Percy and wanted to go to Walker Percy country for a spring vacation. And I said, fine, we'll go down there, but what's in it for Dad? And after some research, what was in it for Dad was a canoe trip in the a brief one in the Atchafalaya Swamp with an LSU professor and another friend of ours. And the four of us went out into the swamp. And while I was there, I learned that all of the water in the swamp was controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at a place called Old River, where they were valving the Mississippi and preventing it from going off in a direction in which the Mississippi wants to go, but in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers want it not to go. And I thought that was a wonderfully symbolic situation of the flat-out struggle between human beings and nature, because the Mississippi has greatly shifted its course down there about once every 1,000 years. And the time had come in the 1950s and thereabout for this to happen. And so they're down there trying to prevent it. And when I got the idea of doing a piece on that and all its implications and ramifications, I thought of doing more pieces in the same theme. And a man at the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg said, well, if you're interested in this theme, you ought to go to Los Angeles and look into the debris basins. And I said, you know, the debris basins? And he said, yeah, they're catching the falling rocks of the San Gabriel Mountains to keep them off Johnny Carson and so on.
One of your three pieces in the new book is called Los Angeles Against the Mountains, and it's about the debris flow. There's a paragraph in that I'd like you to read that kind of describes the magnitude of the debris.
In geology, it would be known as a debris flow. Debris flows amass in stream valleys and more or less resemble fresh concrete. They consist of water mixed with a good deal of solid material, most of which is above sand size. Some of it is Chevrolet size. Boulders bigger than cars ride long distances in debris flows. Boulders grouped like fish eggs pour downhill in debris flows. The dark material coming toward the Genophiles was not only full of boulders, it was so full of automobiles it was like bread dough mixed with raisins. On its way down Pine Cone Road, it plucked up cars from driveways and the street. When it crashed into the Genophiles' house, the shattering of safety glass made terrific explosive sounds. A door burst open. Mud and boulders poured into the hall. "We're going to go," Jackie thought. "Oh, my God, what a hell of a way for the four of us to die together."
It's really wonderful descriptive writing in that paragraph. I really like the Chevrolet-sized boulders. I think it was just the right word to use. How do you choose your subjects? Actually, what I'm wondering is if you've ever bailed out of a subject, if you've ever started to write about a person or a phenomenon or a place and decided that you made the wrong choice and you weren't going to go through with it.
Early in the process, early in the cycle, I mean, you know, you get an idea and then something begins that might fetch up a year or two, certainly months, but maybe a year or two or three later with a finished piece of work. And very early, something might not work out. Or after some travel, but I've never begun. I mean, if I begin writing something, I think it's going to be okay, or I wouldn't be beginning it. And then there's so much just difficulty along the way, and I lose confidence so much that if I were to quit at that point, I wouldn't know whether it was because it wasn't working out or because I was chickening out. So I always finish.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer John McPhee. I've always thought of your style in part as finding the macrocosm and the microcosm, looking at something very specific and looking at it so carefully that suddenly things much larger, ideas much larger begin to emerge. And this one person or one phenomenon that you're looking at becomes almost a metaphor for things larger than itself. Does that jive at all with the way you see your kind of writing?
Well, I sort of hope that happens. I'm glad to hear you say that. but I don't, I think it would be dangerous to sit down and say, and force something like that. You know, you just by attending to the story you're trying to tell, you may hit such a level. But I don't consciously try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is John McPhee, and he has a new book called The Control of Nature. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is John McPhee, who's one of America's most revered writers and has been at The New Yorker for around 25 years. His new book, The Control of Nature, is about man's attempts to alter nature to ward off natural disasters. What's the longest amount of time you've ever spent on one story?
3 years.
And which one was that?
Coming into the Country.
What was it about Alaska?
About Alaska.
And you lived there for the full 3 years or
no,
you went back
oh
and
no.
forth?
No, I went up there about 4 times for visits ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. And in the rest of the time, I was at home in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, working on that piece at home. There was a great deal of reading involved, and of course, the writing always takes longer. I was figuring the other day, it takes about 7 days in Princeton for every one that I'm out somewhere, generally.
You mean 7 days of writing?
Yeah. I mean, people will ask me, does your family miss you? And I say, they're only too happy to get rid of me because I'm back there writing, you know, 7 or 8 days for every one that I'm traveling. And so, and furthermore, the writing goes on. I mean, it might last 15 months, the 15 months of writing. And if you've ever lived with somebody who's doing 15 months of writing, you'd be glad to get rid of them too. And so then the time comes up and I go off for a couple of weeks and then come back again. That's how it works. It's most of the effort is at the, you know, in the locked away in a room by yourself.
Do you feel really differently about the part of your work which takes you out into the world, out to, say, Alaska, and the part of your work which keeps you in your room with the typewriter locked up writing?
I certainly do. And there's a cycle that I mentioned earlier, and the part that when I'm out in Alaska is really quite splendid, and I'm very lucky to be there and to be able to do that. And the part when I'm doing the writing is a process in which I begin with zero confidence every time and gradually build up a little bit over a very long period of time as this the writing itself slowly accumulates.
What's responsible for the zero confidence when you know your track record?
I don't know, but I can tell you that I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah, no, I don't.
But I don't know.
Doubt that.
I mean, I don't know why. I don't. If it's the first draft, maybe this. When you are putting together a piece of writing, in its initial phase, you have nothing, and you are trying to suspend your life so you can recreate something that went on in life a little before, and you do not write well right away. And if you're going to get anything done at all, you have to blurt out something, and it's going to be bad. And to sit there and do something that's bad all day long is unpleasant. But when you've done this enough, you have the so-called rough draft. And at that point, when I do have a draft, something's on paper and it's really miserable, I change a little. When I'm confronting that material that exists, the writing that actually exists, I can work on it and make it better, and I relax a little, and I get a little more confident when I'm in that second, third phase, or whatever, how many times it takes.
You're notoriously obsessive about your writing. Can you describe how you organize the notes that you've taken back with you from the place that you've been writing about?
Well, I copy them all first on a typewriter. It used to be, now it's in a hard disk, and then when all the notes are assembled in this one document, I study that and look for a structure for the piece of writing that will rise out of those notes, rise organically out of the material that I have there and not be imposed from the outside. I mean, a prefabricated structure is not what I would want to find, but an organization, a sequence for the material that I would be dealing with, and that makes sense and that yields the best result through juxtapositions of things and whatever can legitimately be done within the context of a factual piece of writing, and that excites me quite a bit, and it might last for several weeks with a long piece as I try to figure all this out. And then arrange it so that when I begin a piece of writing, I always know where it's going to end and where it's going to go. The notable exception to this is that I haven't mentioned is that I always write a beginning, a lead, first, because that really primes the pump. If you have a successful lead and you know that it works and it makes sense in terms of the piece, that it doesn't promise too much, and that it arrests attention in a fair way, then I stop and go back and do all that organizing I'm talking about.
Can I read you the lead from the first essay in The Control of Nature?
Please.
And I'd like to know how you hit on this and knew that this would be the way to start. 300 miles up the Mississippi River from its mouth, many parishes above New Orleans and well north of Baton Rouge, a navigation lock in the Mississippi's right bank allows ships to drop out of the river. In evident defiance of nature, they descend as much as 33 feet, then go off to the west or south.
So why did I use that lead?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the ships are dropping out of the river and going off to the west or south. If that's happening, the river must want to go there too. So we have the very basic situation, but it's presented in terms of the ships and in a way that I hope will
exemplify.
Yeah, exemplify it and make somebody want to find out, hey, why is this? Why would a big boat go out of the Mississippi River 300 miles from its mouth and go downhill on water? There's something odd about that. And of course, the something odd about that is what the whole piece is about. And I like to say that a lead ought to shine like a flashlight down into the whole piece, if possible. And I hope that one does.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about organizing the notes that you bring home. Physically, how do you organize it? Physically, how do you organize all the information you have before you've actually written it up?
Say I've decided that there are 16 parts of this story. This is just by making little notes as I go along and then looking at those notes, boiling them down. And then I end up with the idea that my body of notes, 55,000 words of notes or whatever it is, this body of notes is going to work out in 16 parts, but I don't know what's first, second, third, or fourth. And then I might put a little something on a 3x5 card that identifies each of those 16 parts. And then I will look at those cards for a long while to see relationships. What might go next to what? Some things have to be where they are because that's when it happened, but you can use flashbacks, flash forwards. There's all sorts of ways, quite legitimately, to arrange a piece of writing. And what you're looking for is to have this material yield the best dividends through structure. And then I go through the whole body of notes and look at each note. And I'll go down from one note to another and assign it to one or another of those 16 places. And I used to then tear up the notes with a pair of scissors or something, but I have a friend at Princeton named Howard Strauss who has written stuff for my computer which causes it to, it'll dive into those notes, it'll take the whole 55,000 words, it'll throw them up in the air, it'll fluff them up to about 75,000 words, and it'll cause them all to settle down into 16 files with 16 names attached to them that are all in the hard disk and the original preserve too. And all this occurs in 4 minutes while I sit there watching a red light.
Right.
But it's the same thing I used to do with Xerox and stuff like that. And it sounds very mechanical, all this, but the purpose is to separate the material, to put it away so that when I'm doing a given section, one of those 16 things, I know what's in it, I can read over those notes, and thus I'm liberated to write. I have no excuses. That's the purpose. The purpose is to, of all that, is to get me out into no man's land where it's just myself and this machine now, the computer that I stare at all day.
My guest is writer John McPhee. You had told an interviewer for the New York Times that back when you were getting started writing after college, when you were writing for a TV drama series, Robert Montgomery Presents, that you used to every morning put on your bathrobe and, you know, put the tie around it and then use that tie to tie yourself to the chair so that you'd stay put
it was
by the typewriter and write.
The the sash or cord that, you know, whatever it is in a bathrobe that goes around your waist.
Yeah.
And the chair was a so-called captain's chair with a vertical spindles, you know, around mm-hmm. the back. So mm-hmm. I threaded it in and out of that and then around me. And one time the doorbell rang. I was in an apartment in New York and I stood up to go answer the door and the chair got up with me.
Well, did that help, actually tying yourself to the chair?
No, it's just an illustration of how miserable writing can be. And, and I mean, I'm not a sedentary person. I don't belong in a chair.
Uh-huh. So what do you do now to keep yourself in the chair?
Well, I'm older and I can sit still a little better. And that was, you know, I was 23 years old or something like that, 24, when that happened. I've been at it so long, I actually sort of relish the time alone. I have no difficulty sitting in that room for all those hours by myself because I guess I just learned to do that through time.
Mm-hmm. Although you spend much of your life talking to people for pieces that you'll be writing, you actually do very few interviews yourself. I mean, you allow yourself to be interviewed very seldom. And I was wondering why.
Well, I don't know. It's complicated. First of all, I'm always behind in my work. But for another thing, it's my work that I hope that will be known, not so much myself. I mean, I enjoy doing this once in a while, but I prefer just to publish the material and go home.
Mm-hmm. This explains
too
why
there's not a very good answer.
Well, this explains too why there's so few pictures of you.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think a writer should intrude between a piece of writing and a reader.
But you use the first person in your pieces.
Where I have to, if I have to. I mean, there are situations. If you're on a canoe trip with a group of people and you're one of the people, it would be ridiculous not to. And if there's other situations. I did a thing once about an experimental aircraft. It was called the deltoid pumpkin seed. And it was 60,000 words long. And there was one place in this whole story where I needed to appear as I. And that is that near the end, when this thing finally got itself going and was up off the ground, another person in the group got into a Cessna to fly up and fly with it, and I went with him. And at that point, I had to say, I got in the Cessna. Otherwise, how did this author suddenly appear 1,000 feet in the air? And so I took that into the New Yorker, and my editor there, Bob Bingham, said, that just can't be. That it sticks out like a sore thumb, this I way over near the far end of the story. And he said, can't you find a place at least to do it one other time? And so I hunted around in the front of the piece and found a scene that happened in a Exxon station somewhere, and I put the I in there, and I still regret it. but only because it didn't belong. I mean, I'm not shy to say I if there's no alternative.
Well, John McPhee, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about writing. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been John McPhee. His new book is called The Control of Nature. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. McPhee is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be marine botanist Sylvia Earle. She's been called one of the most intrepid divers in the history of underwater exploration. She swam with humpback whales and recently met with other scientists to survey the Alaskan oil spill. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you asked Lowell Ganz what he does for a living, he'd say screenwriter. But if you really pressed him to define his life in one word, he'd say parent. Coming up, Lowell Ganz talks about co-writing the movie Parenthood. Also, Eileen Segalov is our tour guide for a trip through the Museum of Jurassic Technology, a place where science and surrealism meet. And we hear a new poem from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. Rescue teams have called off their search for Texas Congressman Mickey Leland until dawn. Searchers have found no trace of the twin-engine plane that vanished with Leland and 15 others on Monday in southern Ethiopia. The U.S. Embassy says apparent distress signals thought to be coming from the plane turned out to be false. Earlier today, Leland's press secretary, Alma Newsom, expressed frustration at the lack of progress and suggested the Bush administration was not doing enough.
What we're appealing for is for President Bush to get involved and to issue a strong statement to all of his people that this is a priority, they've got to work together, and they have got to get their act together and find Congressman Leland and his party.
President Bush later said he understood the anxious frustration of those close to Leland and defended U.S. rescue efforts. More sophisticated American search aircraft have been ordered to Ethiopia to widen the search. Interesting. That's what White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater is calling a statement from the Hezbollah spiritual leader that he's ready with conditions to help free Western hostages in Lebanon. But Fitzwater added that the administration wants to lower its voice, let the hostage issues play out, and see what happens. In Poland, workers staged an hour-long strike today to call attention to their economic demands. The job action affected several hundred enterprises, Jane Dobia reports.
Employees from state-run enterprises are demanding immediate wage increases. They want to make up for the loss they suffered when drastic price hikes were introduced earlier this month. Workers also called for liquidation of nomenklatura, a system of appointing Communist Party favorites to top business posts. As a result of nomenklatura, firms are often run by directors who have hardly any management skills. Today's warning strike was organized by Solidarity. Workers at the Lenin shipyard, where the trade union was born, took part in the job action. The strikes hit almost 500 enterprises in Gdańsk, Sopot, and Gdynia on the Baltic coast. Similar job actions were waged in Warsaw. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The suspended American diplomat suspected of spying for the Soviet Union has given an interview to Austrian television. Felix Bloch admits being in Paris the day he reportedly met with a Soviet agent, but according to the reporter who conducted the interview, Bloch declined to say whether he dined with the agent or left a briefcase for him, as reported. Two more U.S. passenger planes made unscheduled landings today. Vibration in the nose gear of an American Airlines DC-10 forced it to return to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Earlier, a Braniff Airways 727 made an emergency landing at Newark International Airport after a gauge erroneously indicated a problem with the hydraulic system. Both planes landed safely. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 28 points today to close at 2683.99. Volume was heavy. 200 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The learner must be led always from the familiar to the unfamiliar. Commentator Eileen Segalov found these words on a brochure from an unusual museum that she recently visited in her hometown, Los Angeles.
The other day, a friend suggested I visit a place he'd accidentally discovered on his lunch break. He'd taken a left instead of a right and ended up on a bleak boulevard full of Indian sweet stores, CD video shops, a Hare Krishna center, and a pet dinette. "You've got to go," he urged me, "to the Museum of Jurassic Technology." Jurassic Technology. I looked up Jurassic in my 1928 Book of Knowledge. It said, a slice of geologic time, 200 million years ago, when the first birds took to the air. Sounds old, Was there technology back then? A man playing an accordion stood in front of a nondescript storefront. Looming high above his head was a sign made of raised gold letters that looked like they were cast in another era. This must be the place. I opened the heavy metal door and walked in. The museum was full of glass cases, bathed in pools of blue light. My eyes instantly spotted a beautifully printed sign inside of an empty display. It read, "Zinc box used to hold sacrificial human heart, temporarily removed for study." I spun around and noticed a strange projectile on the wall above me. Horn grown on back of woman's head, from a Mary Davis of Sog Hall in Cheshire, 1688. Wait, this place is starting to sound like some kind of sideshow, and it's not. But just what kind of natural history repository is this?
The Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles, California, is an educational institution dedicated to the advancement of knowledge and the public appreciation of the Lower Jurassic.
An informative audiovisual presentation tells you all about the history of the museum and the ever-changing, rotating exhibits.
Walking through the museum, the visitor experiences, as it were, a walk back in time. The first exhibits encountered are the contemporary displays, and reaching the far end of the museum, the visitor is surrounded by the earliest exhibits.
I picked up the museum brochure on my way to the back exhibits and noticed a map of ancient Egypt, drawn with two arrows pointing to Upper and Lower Jurassic. This was confusing. I thought Jurassic had to do with time, not place. I looked around for a clue when I accidentally ran into a woman, totally mesmerized, in front of a diorama featuring the deep-pronged Maori bat from northern South America. "Quick, it's starting," she gasped, handing me one of the two telephone receivers hanging in front of the case.
Before you is an exhibit documenting the remarkable history of the scientific discovery of an equally remarkable creature, the Myotis lucifugus. The history of this discovery spans two centuries, involves what was for many years a highly controversial hypothesis, and intertwines the research of two very different scientists.
The story goes on, with spotlights in the case illuminating various artifacts from the study, charts, models, and the scientist's actual notes and writing desk. Apparently, a bat penetrated the arm of a 5-year-old child, but the arm showed no wounds of any kind. Also, it was reported some natives saw 6 Maoris fly straight into and out of the dining room walls of a family residence, right in the middle of dinner.
The key idea in the Griffith hypothesis was that as the Myotis lucifugus emission increased in frequency, the emission actually crossed the threshold from the extreme ultraviolet into the X-ray, thereby allowing the bat to fly unharmed through solid objects.
I looked at the data inside the case and wondered, what really is fact, and what is truth, and what's the difference? I wandered over to another display. It housed two real-looking hands cradling a little bird. A microscopic-sized EKG machine clicked on the minute I approached and began monitoring the bird's heart rate on a tiny chart. Like a wax museum, this place has a life of its own. At night when it's closed, well, you never know what might happen. Now, I know this is crazy talk, especially because my dad was a scientist. I grew up in a strictly scientific household. It's got to be 100% accurate. There's no room for subjectivity, was Dad's motto. This place would make him nuts. It looks and feels so much like science, but the exhibits are definitely operating on more than the normal diorama realm of show and tell. There are lots of other things to see and hear. Displays on protective auditory mimicry, an exact scaled-down model of Noah's Ark, a huge, haunting scientific illustration of an Iroquois Indian fetish that was a head whose eyes sometimes look open and sometimes closed, and a catoptric camera attached to a terrarium inviting me into a wolf's head with a videotape of a man barking inside the wolf's mind. Where are the regular exhibits? The ones that show you how fire was discovered, why a frog croaks, or the origins of aluminum foil. This place is like a slip on a banana peel onto the flip side of science. I almost feel like just trying to describe the museum might make the whole place disappear. All I can tell you is, when I left and went next door to the Indian sweet shop for a hot samosa and mango milkshake, I felt transformed and blessed. I'd gotten the chance to eke through a crack in space and time and made it out, all in one piece. I was elated that another world existed right next door to the one I've always felt a little limited by.
Although the path has not always been smooth, over the years, the Museum of Jurassic Technology has adapted and evolved until today it stands in a unique position among the institutions in the country. A spirit which has been described as incongruity born of the overzealous spirit in the face of unfathomable phenomena.
Eileen Segalov is an artist and writer based in Los Angeles. The Museum of Jurassic Technology is located at 9341 Venice Boulevard in Los Angeles. From September 26th to October 28th, the museum's collection will be on exhibition in San Francisco at New Langston Arts. This is Fresh Air. Writer Lowell Ganz has three, his writing partner Babalu Mandel has six, and his friend film director Ron Howard has four. Together, they're parents of 13 children and collaborators on the new film Parenthood. Ganz met Ron Howard on the set of Happy Days. Howard starred in the show, and Ganz was one of Happy Days' writers and producers. Together with Mandel, Ganz wrote Ron Howard's hit film Splash. When the three of them got together to work on Parenthood, the time was right to make a film that was close to their lives.
My partner, Babalu, and I had it in our heads, I don't remember why, that we wanted to work and do our next script something very reality-based. We wanted to work in that style. And then almost simultaneous to that, Ron Howard said that he wanted to do a movie about being a dad. And he didn't know what form it should take at that point, but the subject matter seemed just perfect for the style of movie that Babalu and I were enthusiastic about writing right at that time.
Is there a parent in Parenthood that you most identify with?
Well, I think all of us, Babalu and I and Ron and Brian Grazer, the producer, all identified heavily with Gil.
The Steve Martin character.
We all sort of considered ourselves this kind of, I don't know, for want of a, you know, modern dad, or, you know, the kind of dad who felt that it was part of his job to do everything and do everything well.
There's a scene, and I hope you don't mind my giving this away, in which Steve Martin has this fantasy. The first fantasy is that his son is a valedictorian, and the whole assembly stands up to applaud this fabulous father who bred such a boy. And then the second later, he has another fantasy where his son's a mass murderer, and everybody's pointing at him accusingly, like, you're the father whose son is murdering everybody we know. Have you had that fantasy?
Well, not specifically those, but I think we all. I mean, I have a terrible tendency to engage in catastrophic thinking.
Yeah.
it's a real problem of mine, and I just found that most people I know who are really just very committed to the idea of parenthood muse, and you get very much too bound up in expectations.
Rick Moranis plays a father who uses his home as the perfect laboratory to breed the perfect intelligent child.
Our children are more capable of retaining and absorbing information than we are, and yet we insist on treating them like adorable little morons.
What are you saying? Patty can learn things I can't learn?
Patty, which one of these is the square root of 8,649?
'93.
They're like sponges, Gil, just waiting to absorb.
I'm sure you know parents like that. I think we've all met parents like that. Do these people scare you?
They terrify me. And not only do they terrify me, but they make you feel very guilty because, you know, they come over to the house and your kid is doing whatever and they say, you let your child drink soda? And you go, well, yeah, sometimes I guess I do, kind of. You're letting them have sugar? Yeah. Oh, you let them watch TV for more than an hour? They're sitting there watching a whole 3-2 shows at the same back-to-back like that? Yeah, I guess I do let them do that. And by the time they leave, you're like, you're destroyed. I mean, you're just convinced you don't care as much as they do. You're lazier than they are. You're just and your kids are ruined because you're not putting in the same effort that they are. So this was sort of our way of fighting back.
Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 40.
Are you ever surprised by how caught up people of your generation are getting with parenting? This is the generation of people who started to have children later. You know, I mean,
yeah.
a lot of people of our generation started to have children later and have gotten just incredibly caught up with it.
I'm impressed by it rather than surprised by it. I mean, you know, I came from a family where my parents were just totally oriented towards us, towards the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they dwelled and obsessed on everything remotely kid-related. So it's not something that, you know, I find, like, odd or new or anything. But I'm sure exactly why Ron suggested it as the topic for his next film is that we all are sort of, even when we're not surprised by it, you're just stunned by the extent to which it takes up your life. That for many of us, if you were really honestly going to define who or what you are, it would be a mom or a dad more than what you do professionally or what you do, you know, recreationally or creatively or anything else.
So how many children do you have?
I have 3.
And how old are they?
10 and a half, 8 and a half, and 4 and a half.
Are you worried about your children seeing the movie and looking for themselves in it and jumping to conclusions about what you think of them?
My kids have seen the movie. They love the movie. I mean, my older two have seen it. My little one hasn't seen it. They love the movie. There's certain things they recognize and they get excited about it. They think it's terrific that those things are there. Fortunately, there's enough space between the kid characters and our kids so that I don't think any of our kids, you know, really feel violated. They just sort of, you know, recognize kind of little amusing dynamics that exist between them and between each other and between them and us.
I really enjoyed the movie a lot, and I really liked
Thank
its
you.
Tone. But I have to tell you that at the very end, I had problems. I thought there was, in a way, too much resolution, and instead of the kind of messy, instead of the wonderful mess that you present uh-huh. families as being, in the end, everything gets really tidied up, and the family becomes an almost religious experience in the way that it's celebrated. And I was wondering what was behind that tone of change, if that represented the way you feel about families, if that was a result of marketing research?
No, it was not the result of marketing research at all. It's for better or worse, it's an honest reflection of the life view of the people who put the movie together. I don't think everything is. Certainly, Tom Hulce's story doesn't get tied up in any pleasing way. But the rest is somebody. I don't completely agree with this, but somebody sort of said that for an hour and a half, we kind of show you a tremendous number of good reasons why maybe you shouldn't have kids. And what our feeling about the whole process, about being parents, was, yes, there are all of those reasons not to do it. And then for some peculiar reason that's almost impossible to describe, at the end, for so many of us, it's just all worth it and a totally compelling experience that we can't resist.
You've been working as a writing team with Babalu Mandel for several years now, and you've written several films that Ron Howard has directed. Did you all meet while doing Happy Days?
Yeah. Well, I actually met Babalu some years before that, but we both met Ron on Happy Days.
Can you figure out what it is that keeps you working together?
Oh, we've got stuff on him. he doesn't dare not. No, we do share sensibility. I don't know. I think we're a good influence on each other. He trusts us a lot, and it's just been consistently good relationship.
When you're writing a comedy like Parenthood, after the screenplay is written, do you go back and add more humor? is there a section where you just put in, punch up the funny lines?
No,
we
never go back to punch up,
mm-hmm.
specifically for jokes. Everything that went back was just to was all characters. Your first pass through, maybe you've got three or four characters that are sort of fulfilled and you're happy with, and several others that are just there. They're just kind of populating the movie, and all of the reworking of it was just to try to find each character.
You've written all your screenplays in collaboration with Babalu Mandel. What's your technique for writing together? Are you in the same room the whole time calling out lines to each other?
Absolutely. It's a very improvisational kind of form of writing. We have a scene and we know where we want to get to, and we have characters, and presumably before we write any scene or any character, we've done a lot of work between us in having a feel for who the people are and how they sound. And if one of us opens our mouths and starts talking in character, the other one theoretically should have absolutely no problem recognizing immediately which character is speaking. And we write absolutely head-to-head. We're 3 feet away from each other across one desk. One of us is holding a ballpoint pen over a blank piece of white paper. And we write the entire movie that way.
Lowell Ganz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, that's okay. I enjoyed it.
Lowell Ganz co-wrote the new film Parenthood with his partner Babalu Mandel. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight's program has a report about staff members of Congressman Mickey Leland's office complaining that the U.S. government hasn't done enough in trying to locate the Texas congressman missing in Ethiopia. And Robert Siegel and John Rockwell, music critic of the New York Times, will be talking about the new string quartets. We'll hear some music and hear from members of the American, the Kronos, the Turtle Island, and the really eclectic string quartets. At NPR's Peter Breslow, once an Eagle Scout about 20 or so years ago, goes to the Boy Scout Jamboree, which was held this week at Fort A.P. Hill in Virginia. He goes to see how things may have changed with the Scouts.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday is with us again to read a new work called Saxes and Selves.
I saw you going into Saxes steak sandwiches, but what were you thinking? It was a hot day. The downtown traffic smashed itself right through. People wore their primary colors and touched the doors and parking meters and bottles and quarters and steering wheels and the hold-on bars and bouncing buses with tough hands, tools made of tough skin. The sun was some 10 degrees hotter than anybody expected. People folded their jackets and went to deal. You must have been dealing, too. But what were you dealing with? You came out of Sax's steak sandwiches with a large Coke to go, straw stuck through plastic lid. But what were you contemplating? There was sweat in all armpits. 3 10-year-old boys had a hardball. One of them shouted, "Up your ass!" and laughed. 15 blocks away, an enormous insurance building glittered with its violent impregnability in the hot sky. It was real as the hot yellow gas truck, which was as real as the spice in Sax's chili, and so were you, no doubt. But what was your real point? I mean, what did you add up to? You caught the Dudley bus and sat next to a blind young man whose fingers flickered every minute or so in something like a diffident farewell to someone important who might not return for a long time. Staring at the fingernails of the rider across from you, you tapped your foot to a song called "Staying Alive" from a black girl's huge radio, and you may even have hummed along while sucking ice from your tall cup. However, the song's meaning for you is not apparent, and I don't know why you got off where you did, chucking your drained cup in a dumpster, rolling up your sleeves as you passed the Purity Supreme. I know exactly where you got off and how hot the air was, but damn you, what were you thinking? I've tried to figure it, but it comes out different each time, and I can't be bothered. Really, if you have some hang-up about being mysterious, it's not my problem. So unless you're willing to give me a clue, just the general area, the basic subject, something to get started is all. You don't have to fork over your whole self. But if it's just going to be trivia, your shoes, your Coke, your moving lips, then forget it. I'm serious. Just forget the whole thing.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Danny Miller is the senior producer of Fresh Air. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and commentaries with assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Well, I'm heading off on vacation, and Sedge Thompson, our friend from KQED in San Francisco, is flying cross-country to fill in. We wish him a good trip and look forward to having him here. I'm Terry Gross. Talk to you soon.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet marine biologist Sylvia Earle. She's a master at exploring the ocean's depths and broke the deep-sea diving record. Also, sports writer Philip Hose examines the racial barriers that still exist in American sports. That and more next time on Fresh Air.